Thanks, Doc Daly. Thank you again for tuning in for today's in-depth interview. Today, I welcome my partner in Mining Stock Daily. That's Dave Kranzler of Investment Research Dynamics, and we have a great conversation all about the overall markets, what it means for precious metals, and Dave also gets into a little bit of his hypothesis with base metals and copper, and also we go into a few mining stocks that we both have interest in, and he gives a little bit of an overall briefing of what those companies are up to. So look forward to airing that for you in just a couple seconds. But first, we definitely want to thank our sponsors for Mining Stock Daily. That's Brixton Metals, Western Copper and Gold,
Pacific Empire Minerals,
Port for the show. We really appreciate everything you do. And we also look forward to potentially welcoming everybody in here in the next week and a half. We're going to have 200 episodes of Mining Stock Daily. That's pretty crazy to think about. It's and even less than a year. Can you believe it? Yeah, we couldn't do it without you, the listeners. So, we really appreciate you tuning in every day. So without further ado, I'm going to get into my conversation with Dave Kranzler. Remember, if you're listening to this on Amazon Alexa, you are listening to an abbreviated version of the conversation. The full interview can be found on basically any other network you get your podcasts on, like iTunes or Spotify, Podbean. So, just know that if you want the full interview, you got to go to the podcast plays. So, without further ado, thank you so much. Here's my conversation with Dave Kranzler. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Mining Stock Daily. And with me is my partner in this endeavor. That's Dave Kranzler from Investment Research Dynamics. Dave, good to talk to you once again. Welcome back to the show. And, before we get started, thanks for everything you do for the show and all the insight and night before scripting you put together for us.
Oh, well, my pleasure. Am I a partner in this endeavor or a partner in crime?
Yeah, it doesn't. At this stage, does it really matter anymore? I mean, we're both getting robbed.
Yeah.
Based on the markets.
We're victims. We're victims of crime.
We are victims of crime.
Crime that should be regulated but isn't regulated.
So we're actually we are approaching the 200th episode of Mining Stock Daily. Can you believe it? Remember when you and I first sat down and I had this crazy idea and wanted to get your thoughts on it and see if you'd participate? That was like almost 2 years ago.
Yeah, I remember sitting in your office and you're like, now how do we do this? And you had to get your credit card out to sign up for, I think it was for the Anchor. Was it Anchor?
Yeah, the Anchor subscription.
Yeah.
And that's, at first we started out as the first Amazon Alexa show within this industry, and now we're distributing to 12 or more different networks, and it's a lot easier to have you with me to help me out with this. So thanks so much.
My pleasure. I feel honored to be part of it.
So let's stop the sappiness and let's get down to business here. We're going to get into a couple different things, specifically on the mining side, investing in junior mining stocks. But this week we're seeing what would appear like a back to a downturn in the overall markets. I mean, the Dow's been down 2 points here 2 days this week. The mainstream media is kind of pointing the finger at the U.S.-China trade war or tariffs. I don't know if it's a war yet, but it certainly feels like it. You and I, we've chatted off mic a little bit that, even though that's where the finger pointing is, that's not necessarily telling the entire story. What's your thoughts on it, and kind of give our listeners a little bit of an idea of where else this thing might be headed and why?
Sure. The trade war is a symptom of the underlying problem, and the underlying problems are the same problems that caused the 2008 financial crisis. And all they did with all of this money printing is they stimulated an artificial economic recovery. It was stimulated by monetary inflation and inflation of the amount of debt outstanding. So now all the debt and the derivatives that caused the problems the first time around, now all of that is at record levels. They changed some of the rules on derivatives accounting to make it easier to disguise the outstanding amount of derivatives. But we're I mean, we're at all-time highs in any type of credit instrument and any type of derivatives instrument, and that includes precious metals derivatives instruments. So, you know, what's happened is that the income, the real wealth that's generated by the underlying economy, it isn't high enough now to cover the debt and derivative obligations. So, Trump, for some reason, got pissed off at the trade deficit, and, you know, part of his Make America Great campaign is, oh, well, we need to stimulate industrial activity here and stimulate our exports, and China's robbing us. Well, no, China's not robbing us by selling us cheap goods. That was an intended policy put into place by Robert Rubin and Bill Clinton in 1995. A lot of listeners probably don't even remember this, but they put in place it was the Clinton-Rubin strong dollar policy, and at the same time, they opened up the avenues with China that led to the deindustrialization of our industries. And Walmart and Boeing were two of the first companies that moved over to China and started producing over there because they could produce using labor at 50 cents a day instead of $50 an hour, including benefits. So any kind of mess that we might be in with regard to trade competitiveness is our own doing. And the fact that the U.S. dollar is still, for the most part, the reserve currency of the world gives us an advantage over everyone. So if China manipulates its currency or undercuts its pricing behind the scenes, all it's doing is trying to equalize the playing field that's been unequal for the better part of, you know, 20 to 30 years.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach to it. I mean, it's almost like your take at it is almost like re-engineering what the U.S. Investor or even somebody who's definitely just watching the economy is been kind of told to believe for the last 10 years. And that's a heavy thing for me to say, Dave, because you know me, the thing I like about our relationship more and more is that we're kind of like the yin and the yang. You're a little bit more pessimistic than I am, but yet, you know, through our conversations, like I think there's starting to, I feel like there's a sense of realism's kind of setting in on the overall markets and where we're at. And I think this, what you just said, there's some foundation to that belief as well. But let's get back to precious metals. I mean, even today we're seeing the Dow down over 400 points at the time of recording. It's Thursday morning when we're recording this, but yet gold hasn't really seen much of an upward push. I mean, nothing. I mean, I think it's up $3 right now. Silver's still in the red. I mean, what's this action telling you?
Well, I mean, you can't really have a conversation about gold without bringing intervention, market intervention, into the conversation. And anyone who doesn't understand the degree to which the precious metals market is manipulated would never be able to make sense of what's going on. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you run a rate of return analysis on gold versus the Dow and start that at 2000 and run it to now, gold has outperformed the Dow over that time period. And that fact probably would surprise a lot of people. What's happened now is you've got a bifurcated gold market. You've got the physical gold buying and trading market in the Eastern Hemisphere, you know, and the largest gold importing countries in the world are in the Eastern Hemisphere, China, Russia, India. In fact, I think China year to date is the number one. I mean, Russia is the number one importing country for gold year to date. That's a figure I just saw about a week ago. And India imported unofficially 120 tons in the month of April, and that was up like twofold from the month before. And what's happening is you're seeing I call it a disintermediation of physical gold, because most of that gold, those countries alone are buying more gold than is produced in the world by the producers, gold miners. And the balance is made up by the West dishoarding gold. I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but if you look at for 2018, the U.S. exported a huge amount of gold. I want to say something like over 200 tons. And gold is that, you know, gold gets hypothecated from vaults in London. And that's just a fancy term for saying, you know, leased out or loaned out to make deliveries into the East. And, you know, at some point there will be a real deficit of physical gold that the only way to fix that is to let the price rise. But in the meantime, the other half of that bifurcated market is the paper derivative gold market in London and New York. And the tail that wags the dog on that is COMEX futures. And if you look at the open interest in COMEX futures, the open interest in terms of the amount of gold that's represented by those futures is, and I haven't run the numbers again in a while, but it's probably at least 3 to 4 times the amount of gold that is reported as being available for delivery or being held in the COMEX vaults that's available for delivery. And it's probably 2 to 3 times more than the total amount of gold in the vaults. And when you get in any other commodity, when you've been in a situation where the amount of open interest in futures exceeds the amount of underlying physical commodity available for delivery by more than like 20 or 30%, the CFTC has cracked down on that situation. A recent example that comes to mind was about, I don't know, it was like maybe 10 or 12 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, JP Morgan got busted for trying to manipulate the, I think it was the natural gas market. So, and that was because they were shorting more futures than they had available of underlying gas to deliver. It might have been oil or something. I forget what it was, an energy commodity. So you have to ask yourself, why is the CTFC looking the other way on, you know, the open interest versus the amount of underlying that's deliverable on the COMEX? And it's because gold and silver are not commodities. They're monetary metals, and they're true money. It's true money, you know. And when every dollar that the price of gold goes up invalidates the U.S. dollar by a dollar. So, and you can't have that if you want the dollar to be the reserve currency. And additionally, a rising price of gold reflects the underlying turmoil that's going on in the world financial system and economic system that we were talking about a little bit earlier. And so when the price of gold goes up, it functions as the canary in the coal mine. So what central banks, Western central banks and governments want to do is they want to get that canary out of the coal mine before the miners see it, because they want the miners to stay in the mine and keep working. And that's essentially, the reasons for why the government looks the other way on the manipulation of the gold market. And it's also an enormous source of profits for the Wall Street banks that operate the COMEX.
So let's move on away from precious metals, and I want to talk about copper with you. I know your position on copper. We've discussed it in the past, so let's bring that up for our listeners. And I just want to preface by, like, what you're about to say, I hope you're wrong, but I think it's interesting to hear another perspective. It's always healthy to hear another perspective, especially when it comes to investing and speculating. So why are you so bearish on copper right now?
I wouldn't say that I'm bear, like a super bear on it. What my view is on copper right now is that Wall Street and the financial media and investors, big investors with, you know, interests, with an interest in seeing the price of copper go higher, or at least a lot of people getting interested in copper investments. I think it's the same type of hype that has kind of driven the tech sector higher. It's a hot sector. There's been some high profile, large copper project acquisitions, some major deals in the last 2 years, and so Wall Street's kind of turned it into its hot product to sell du jour. And every time I turn around, there's someone who comes out, you know, in conjunction with promoting a junior copper project, you know, a junior mining company that is developing a copper project, you know, they pull out this supply and demand analysis that shows copper going into a major supply deficit. And, you know, the listeners to this, and you've seen that analysis, you know, ad nauseum. And the problem is, if you look at a long-term chart of copper, and, you know, in my mining stock journal that I'll be releasing tonight, I've got a chart in there that goes back to, I think it goes back to 1990. But if you could extend it back to 1960, and the average price of copper over that period, if you go back to 1990, the average price of copper is $2. If you extend it back to like 1960, it goes below $2. Now, that's not to say that obviously a lot of things have changed in the composition of economies globally and the types of investments that fuel economic growth. However, the big run-up in the price of copper occurred. It was at $2, and in 2005, roughly, it started, you know, a very quick price rise higher. It went over $4 at one point. Well, that not coincidentally happens to coincide with a period of time when China was emerging as a very fast growing economy, and it was overstimulating its economy by overbuilding its infrastructure. I mean, everyone's seen the pictures of the ghost cities that they have over there, you know, anticipating a big movement of people who are, you know, an agrarian-based system, a lot of those people moving into the cities and working more in the manufacturing and service sector. So my thesis is that the demand that China has had for copper over the last 10 or 15 years is not necessarily sustainable for the next 5 or 10 years. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, we're going into, you know, we had the global synchronized recovery, you know, and that's part of what pushed the price of copper higher. Well, now, you know, most people are signing off on this idea of a global synchronized recession, yet you're still seeing people with these hockey stick projections for the price of copper and the supply deficit of copper. And what my thesis is that you can't take the amount of copper that was consumed over the last 10 or 15 years and extrapolate that forward, at least for the next few years. And so I think that we're going to see, you know, if I'm right about the world going, you know, entering into a deep global recession, and I think so far the numbers back this up, you know, we're going to see a sell-off in the price of copper. And we're going to see, you know, I think a lot of these copper-based junior mining stocks that have had big run-ups are going to sell off. And now that's not to say that they're not working on and sitting on really good, valuable projects. I'm just saying that we're going to have to shift forward our expectations for what those projects are worth, you know, until we get clarity on how long, you know, this global downturn we're heading into is going to last. I mean, as an example, all the chip CEO, the semiconductor chip CEOs came out in the first quarter and said, oh, well, you know, we see a second half recovery. And then the ones that started reporting later in the quarter were like, well, the market's still bad. You know, we don't have visibility for next quarter, but we think the fourth quarter we'll see an improvement. Now, none of the CEOs are saying anything about any type of recovery for this year. And I think you can, that analysis is analogous to just the economy in general. And I think we're going to go into a global downturn that's going to be very severe. And even if the central banks try to reflate it by printing a lot more money, all they're going to do is create price inflation. And I think that's going to affect the price of copper, and it's going to affect the stocks that have seen their run-ups derived from bullishness on copper. So I guess I'm not a copper bear per se. I'm just trying to say, you know, I think the market's gotten way ahead of itself, and it's probably worth taking profits in some of these stocks that you might have profits in and wait for the cycle to play through.
Do you think that scenario is likely to extend itself throughout the base metals sector, or do you think it's just copper?
Oh, I think it's going to affect all the base metals. Now, let's separate out gold and silver from there, because gold and silver are not commodities. That was a concept that was introduced by the United States and by Wall Street and by the government after Nixon closed the gold window. I mean, gold futures didn't even trade until 1974. And what they did is they wanted to, since they demonetized gold, they wanted to erase the idea that gold was money in people's minds and silver was money, and instead started, you know, everything started referencing to gold and silver as commodities, and they got included in the group of base metals and depletables, you know, grains and agricultural futures, et cetera, that are true commodities. So I wouldn't put gold and silver, you know, I think we're going to go into a scenario where we'll see gold and silver shoot up for a sustained period. And the base commodities, the real commodities, will probably decline. Although I think, you know, if they print money, you could probably see pretty healthy price inflation in agricultural commodities.
All right. So we've got a few more minutes left. I don't want to keep you too long, but since it is Mining Stock Daily, I thought we'd maybe come back and get some quick updates from you on a few of the mining stocks that you and I are both interested in and have positions in. The first one is something last couple of weeks, you and I were going back and forth again, you know, having some opinions about it or the other, but that would be U.S. Gold. They've seen some pretty good traction, upward momentum in their stock price. I think they're up to about $1.20 this week, and that's about 2 or 3 weeks after they brought on former Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke onto the board. Any updates, company updates that you want to share with our listeners from U.S. Gold?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't know that I'd necessarily correlate that rise in the stock price with the addition of Zinke to the board. The stock just got unnecessarily way oversold. I mean, and it was cheap relative to its peers.
Yeah, it went down to like 85 cents at one
time.
Yeah,
there was,
if not cheaper.
Intraday, it even went lower. And, it probably ran up over $2, you know, for no reason. And it got sold under $1 for no reason. And, you know, most of its peers, which are, Nevada gold project exploration stocks, or, you know, jurisdictions that are, you know, kind of comparable to Nevada, although Nevada's unique. All jurisdictions are unique in their own regard. But, you know, the right market cap right now for those types of companies seems to be somewhere between, you know, say, 18 million and 25 million. And U.S. gold went way below that. And I think part of that is we're seeing kind of the snapback effect. There's not really, in my mind, and, you know, I should preface this by saying U.S. gold's my number one junior mining stock idea, and we have a large position in it. It's by far the largest position in the fund that I manage. It's a speculative play. Make no mistake about that. They haven't proved anything yet other than that they've got the right type of geology that potentially hosts a Carlin-style gold deposit or multiple Carlin-style gold deposits. I mean, it sits on the same trend as Barrick's. Well, now it's Barrick and Gold, or Barrick and Newmont's Cortez Hills gold project, which is one of the largest gold mines in the world. And that's not to say that, you know, there's definitely the property that U.S. Gold has, the Keystone property, 20 square miles. It's definitely loaded with gold mineralization. But then the question becomes, is the geology right so that gold-bearing deposits that are economical, you know, at $1,300 gold, did those form millions of years ago? And that's what they're sticking holes in the ground now trying to figure out. I would say there's a very high probability that they will find some deposits, but it's not guaranteed. I mean, they could drill to their heart's content and come up with mineralized assays that aren't rich enough to justify putting in a mining operation. You know, on the other hand, they stick the drill in the right place and they hit a discovery, And that stock's going to go from a $20 million market cap to a $100 million market cap very, very quickly. And part of that just reflects how starved the world is for new gold discoveries.
Well, yeah, and discoveries are what's rewarding any junior right now, and so, with such low sentiment, it seems like.
Right.
And I will,
I guess, just real quickly, just to kind of put a bow on it. You know, the fact that they have the right geology and the right kind of rocks, you know, leads me to believe that you know, they're going to find something. It's just a matter of time. But we're not going to see any kind of meaningful news come out of U.S. Gold, unless it's related to their Copper King project, probably until late summer, because of the winter, they're not going to be able to start drilling until mid to late June. And it's you know, drilling is where the truth lies. That's what exposes the truth.
Yeah. Another company and project, a very similar situation, very speculative play, but actually up in South Dakota, near the old Homestake Mine. I actually re-entered into a position with Mineral Mountain, and so I wanted to check in with you to see if you've still been following that story, if there's any updates from your end on management with Mineral Mountain, and if they are getting some of that directional drilling in yet, or if they're still prepping for that activity this summer.
They're still trying to raise the money so that they can do the drilling. I'm very optimistic that if they can get funded to do more drilling, they're going to find a discovery. And I think they're on the verge of finding a discovery. I mean, they have historical data from when Newmont owned the property or had, you know, mining claims on the property. And, they, you know, Newmont sunk some pretty rich drill holes in there. I think they know where to put the drill holes to find the mineralization. They just need to raise the money to do it. And it's taking quite a while for them to raise the money, and that makes me a little bit nervous. So my suggestion on Mineral Mountain is if someone wants to, make a horse bet on a semi long shot, buy a small amount, and if they can raise the money, you know, I would probably add to that, add to your position. But at this point, it's not definitive that they're going to be able to raise the money, and so I own it. I'm not selling it. You know, I think it has tremendous upside, but there's also some risks besides just general exploration risks with the company right now.
Right. Well, I'm also very intrigued with the technology that they're using with the directional drilling. I actually asked them about it at PDAC, and they gave me a little bit of a rundown and graphical scope of how that operation's going to work. And I was very curious about how they would report any results they do get just based on how that drilling works. So it'd be really interesting, I think. I mean, obviously, my position was highly speculative. I'm kind of betting that they do raise the money, even though raising and financing projects right now is very tough. I do think it's going to happen just based A, on the technology, and B, on the area that they are operating in.
Nelson Baker is a brilliant geologist, and he's creative and innovative. I mean, he's the one who discovered the Rainy River deposit when no one else wanted to look at it. I mean, it was just sitting there, you know, in prime Canadian gold mining territory, and everyone else shunned it. And he said, nope, there's something there, and I'm going to find it. And I think it's the same, you know, you're betting on the jockey of the horse here, you know, and placing mm-hmm. a bet on him. And I just, for me, it gives me a little bit of pause that it's this hard for them to raise money. But again, as you say, it's a very difficult environment right now to raise money. So,
well, and it's a tough week to talk about who's to blame, the jockey or the horse, right? After the Kentucky Derby. So, all right. Ding, ping. Yeah. Let's real quick. Last thing I want to talk to you. The Mining Journal is about ready to be published. If you're listening to this Friday morning, it has been published. You can find a subscription to the Mining Stock Journal at investmentresearch.com. But you actually provide a couple ideas of companies that you don't recommend anymore. Can you give us a real quick, brief summary of those companies and why?
Sure. One of them is it's a copper project, and it's ultimately eventually going to probably be a prolific copper project. But I point out some red flags if you're thinking about buying it at the current price. You know, I think at the right price, you can make a lot of money on it. And I also think the timeline that they laid out for when they think they'll start mine construction is probably going to be pushed out as well. I think the permitting is going to take longer than they think. And I think if I'm right about the global economy and the price of copper, I think, you know, anyone who might want to finance the mine construction will probably, you know, defer it for a while. So there's that. And then there's a gold stock that popped last week or 2 weeks ago quite a bit on one drill hole. And if I had had the ability to short it, I would have shorted it, but I can't short five letter stocks. My custodian won't let me. And that stock's down about 33%, but it's still, I think it's going to probably get cut in half again at least. And that's not to say that it's not a good project, or that, you know, they're not going to, you know, it's not to say they're not going to find a meaningful deposit, but the economics of the project are skewed toward their prospective joint venture partner. And I think at the right price, you know, again, it's one of those stocks that's probably worth speculating a little bit on, but not certainly didn't deserve the run-up that it had 2 weeks ago. And then there's one more stock that I mentioned in there, and it's this thing trades below 10 cents, and they have a really interesting property that's next to one of the largest gold mines in the world, and they're going to start exploring it, and hopefully they'll start drilling, you know, mid to late summer. And this is the type of stock that if it does make a discovery or some rich mineralization with a couple of drill holes, this is definitely a stock that could easily triple or quadruple overnight. So I talk about that stock in the latest issue also.
Well, speaking of the right price, I believe the Mining Stock Journal subscription is, what, $20 a month?
Yes.
And so, as you like to script out for me time to time, it's a no-brainer. Go to investmentresearchdynamics.com, pick you up a subscription. You can cancel at any time, right, Dave?
Yes. Well, no time commitment beyond the first month.
Okay, there you go. Dave, you're the man. Thank you so much for joining us and providing all your insight, and look forward to another 200 episodes.
Likewise, Trevor. It's been a pleasure to work with you.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Dave.